ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
You're listening to The Country Hour on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
Hello, Brooke Neindorf with you for The Country Hour today. Coming up, the long road ahead for a Victorian winemaker after the Longwood bushfire ripped through his property.
If you look all around, we're both sides of the hill and you can see that it's just everything is black. Every square inch of our place was burnt out, with the exception of very small areas at just unbelievable breakneck speed. So, you know, you can see what a large area it is, and all of it was burnt out.
We'll have more on that story shortly. Plus, we'll check in on Queensland as well. And the table grape harvest has started for some as well. But first today, the River Murray downstream of the Darling River is now listed as critically endangered under national environment law. The decision by the federal government follows extensive consultation and scientific advice. So what does this mean for people who live and work along the river? Federal Minister for Water and Environment, Murray Watt, explains.
Yeah, so it really is intended to cover, I guess, what everyone considers as the lower Murray catchment. So all of the Murray River and its ecosystem as a whole, all the way through South Australia, but then just stretching slightly over the border, basically to the point where the Darling River intersects with the Murray River at Wentworth in New South Wales. So it's basically the entire downstream area from that point where the two rivers meet. And the way to think about it is that it's not just about protecting and listing the river itself, although that is part of it. It's really about covering the waterways, the wetlands, the floodplains and the vegetation of the River Murray downstream from that point where it intersects with the Darling.
What were the drivers that were noted, particularly from the Threatened Species Committee, that prompted this listing and declaration to happen?
Yeah, so as you said in your intro, we have relied on the advice from the Threatened Species Scientific Committee, which is a body of independent scientific experts. They undertook a wide-ranging study and consultation with all sorts of groups, from scientists, environmentalists, farmers, others as well. And basically what they found was that despite the efforts that governments and the community has made to restore the health of the Lower Murray, it still remains under very great stress. You know, your listeners, of course, would be aware of some of the issues upstream when it comes to the over-extraction of water, and that has undoubtedly had an impact on the Lower Murray over the decades. But it's also things like invasive species, feral animals, weeds, salinity, erosion. There's a range of different factors that have contributed to this. And of course, in addition, we know that we face greater impacts from climate change around droughts and floods, which are having environmental consequences as well. So it's really a mixture of those factors which has led the committee to make this recommendation that we list this catchment, this Lower Murray, as critically endangered. And I'm happy to talk about what that sort of means in practical terms if you'd like as well.
This is not the first time this has happened, though. It was the Rudd government that listed it in 2013. Does that mean that this isn't a permanent situation?
Yeah, this does have a long history, Matt, and unfortunately, this is not the first time that a federal government has listed this river system as critically endangered. You're right, back in 2013, towards the end of the Rudd Labor government, when Mark Butler, a proud South Australian, was the Environment Minister, he listed this river system as critically endangered. But unfortunately, a few months after the Abbott government came in, they removed that listing, which it is possible to do. Basically, there's a parliamentary process now where it would be possible for the Senate to what's known as disallow this listing or remove it. I think it's very unlikely that that will occur given the state of the Senate at the moment. But I guess what happened last time was the beginning of 10 years of neglect under the federal coalition government. It didn't just stop with removing this listing. We saw them fail dismally when it came to water recovery. the 450 gigalitres of additional environmental water that was supposed to be recovered under the Murray-Darling Basin Plan. In nearly 10 years, the Coalition only recovered 2 gigalitres of that 450 gigalitres. And that's obviously one of the factors that has contributed to this listing and the state of the Murray as well.
The release makes the point that areas used for crops and infrastructure won't be affected by this. So will any new plans be subject to approval?
Potentially they will, Matt. And this is, I guess, one of the consequences of this listing is that it gives it a certain status under national environmental law that it doesn't have at the moment. Currently, under our national environmental law, there are aspects of the river system that are endangered. It might be Ramsar wetlands, or it might be threatened species or migratory birds. And even now under the law, if a major new development was likely to have a significant impact on those things, it would require federal environmental approval. What changes as a result of this listing is that now, if a particular development like a mine or a dam or a bridge was going to have a significant impact on the ecosystem as a whole, then that would require federal environmental assessment and approval. Now, I want to make clear, especially for your listeners involved in agriculture, that it won't impact on farmers undertaking their existing activities. So whether it be grazing or cropping, I've been to the Riverland, I've met grape growers, it won't impact on their existing activities, fencing, any of that kind of stuff. But as I say, if someone wanted to come along with a major proposal for, you know, something that was going to impact on the ecosystem as a whole with a major impact on the water flow, then that would require federal assessment and approval.
But if new plans require that approval, won't that stifle growth in communities?
Well, I guess what you've always got to weigh up with these things is the economic benefits that can come from development and also the environmental consequences of those developments. And, you know, that would obviously be a decision case by case about particular projects. When it comes to evaluating them, there are often ways that projects can be designed in a way to minimise or avoid their environmental impacts. But I guess what we're dealing with here, Matt, is that we've had decades of development and activities that have had a major negative effect on the Lower Murray. And if we don't continue the work, whether it be about water recovery or greater protection of that environment, we're going to be facing even more dire consequences for the local economies and the local communities in the future.
All right, I'll come to water recovery in a second. Senator Murray Watt is the Federal Minister for Environment and Water. An announcement made today that the Lower Murray River has been listed as critically endangered. So do we just accept this listing now, or is there work that will happen to try and reverse this?
Well, we certainly as a government have decided to accept this recommendation. I mean, it's been provided by some of the most eminent scientific experts in Australia based on that research and consultation they've undertaken. It'll be a matter for other political parties what position they take on this, but I'd be really disappointed if we saw, for example, the Federal Coalition revert to the sort of neglect and ignoring of the state of the Murray as they have done in the past. The other important thing that will come from this listing is that the committee responsible for the recommendation has given us very comprehensive conservation advice about what should be done in the future. And that's really about informing future government decisions, whether it be about investments or policies when it comes to the Murray. And that'll complement the sort of existing plans that we've got in place, particularly through the Murray-Darling Basin Plan.
There is a lot of environmentalists, scientists working along the river system, particularly in South Australia. Does this mean that there'll be potentially more funding for them to continue their work?
Potentially. I mean, obviously, we'll need to make decisions about those kind of things in future budget rounds. But even now, we have, as a federal government, significantly increased the funding that's available for that kind of research activity, but also for on-ground action as well. We're funding billions of dollars worth, not just of water buybacks and research, but infrastructure projects to improve water efficiency, to try to restore floodplains and remove some of the constraints on water flow. So there's already been a very substantial investment by the Albanese government in the health of the Murray, much more than what we've seen before. And we'll, of course, you know, take into into account this kind of advice when it comes to future decisions as well.
Senator Murray Watt is Federal Minister for Environment and Water. Let's move on to another release that came out today as well, Minister. This is talking about grants being made available for communities affected by the impacts of the water recovery, which was announced by you a little while ago. Why wasn't this grant program put in place at the same time as the buyback scheme was put in place?
Well, we certainly made the announcement at the time that we would be providing funding through state governments to support communities impacted by water recovery. Obviously, it takes a little bit of time to negotiate those sorts of agreements with state governments. We've got an agreement in place with the New South Wales government. We've got not one now with the South Australian government. And we're in a position now where, as of today, we're opening applications for these grants. Basically, what it's about is providing $20 million towards South Australian communities over two rounds, because we recognise that when you do buy back water, that can have some consequences for local industry, for local jobs. And we want to make sure that communities that are impacted in that way remain strong. Now, some of those communities might be able to continue with the sort of industry base that they have now. Some of them might require some adjustment in order to deal with the sort of consequences of water restrictions and water recovery. So that's what these grants are for, is to support that sort of industry and job development. If I look at what New South Wales has done with their grants, there have been projects that have gone forward with this funding around tourism to attract people to particular regions. As I say, there could be feasibility studies into new industries that are funded, and actually even supporting shovel-ready projects as well. So I'd really encourage people in the Lift Riverland to hop on the PIRSA website, which is where people can get, you know, more information about eligibility guidelines, and the applications will be open until the 31st of March.
Okay, so will this be ongoing, considering that the buyback program is continuing as well?
Well, as I say, this funding will be split over two rounds. So what we're announcing today is the opening of applications for the first round. There will be a second round of these grants from that $20 million bucket at a future point. But yeah, look, we'll always consider what further assistance is necessary as we continue to implement the Murray-Darling Basin Plan. When it comes to voluntary buybacks, we're on track to reach 400 of that 450 gigalitre target by the end of this calendar year, which is a damn sight better than what we saw under the coalition over 10 years. And we'll always consider what adjustments assistance is necessary as we continue implementing that plan.
Do you still say that this is the best way forward to recover that water for the environment, given that we now have to put money in for communities who may be affected by that?
Yeah, I guess what we're doing, Matt, is relying on the scientific advice that we need a range of different measures in order to restore the health of the Murray. It's not going to be done overnight. This is a long-term process, but you've got to start somewhere. And, you know, if you think about the economic consequences for South Australia and for the country as a whole, if the Murray-Darling Basin collapses, that would be far, far, far more than $20 million. So we see this as a good investment to support those communities going forward.
Is there still interest in the expression of interest for water buybacks?
So what we've done, and you probably saw the announcement I made towards the end of last year, where we said that we were going to be acquiring more water towards that 450 gigalitre target. When the previous round of buybacks occurred, there was actually a lot more interest in selling water than what we had available to buy at that point in time. So what we've done is go back to those EOIs that were submitted at the time to select more water to be purchased. So we don't need to go out to a new round of tenders or anything like that. And, you know, we'll obviously sort of think about what further steps need to be taken in the future to get us to that 450 gigalitre target.
Federal Minister for Water and Environment Murray Watt speaking with Matt Stevens earlier this morning, talking there about the River Murray and the downstream of the Darling River, now listed as critically endangered under national environment law. And you'll hear more about this throughout the afternoon on your ABC local radio, and you can jump online to read more about it as well at abc.net.au/news. It's 19 minutes past 12.
It absolutely, permanently changed me.
Spend an hour in the life of someone else.
You go into this dangerous landscape of unconscious material, but I kind of like that.
Conversations, this morning from 11 on ABC Radio.
You're listening to The Country Hour on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
Now, it's set to be a wet few days right across large parts of outback Queensland. An ex-tropical cyclone, Koji, has made its way across the state to the west, where some catchments are already saturated after a monsoon trough dropped annual rainfall totals in a matter of days across over Christmas. Graziers across northwest Queensland are still counting the cost of those floods, with the Department of Primary Industries reporting more than 54,000 livestock missing or dead so far. Farmer Dudley Harrington runs the Wirina cattle station north of Julia Creek, and he tells Abby Holter that further rain is the last thing they want to see for their stock.
It's going to take us probably the whole year to get an idea of losses. We're definitely seeing losses, especially in young cattle, as we get around large calf losses, obviously due to the how wet it got and how long it was. Paddocks that went completely underwater with flood water and just not seeing many cattle there. But I'm also getting reports from neighbours further down that they've seen some cattle. They've got some of my cattle on them, so just hoping for the best that throughout the year they'll dribble back. But yeah, no, there's definitely going to be some large losses there. And it didn't seem to matter whether you had flood water or not, because a lot of cattle just sort of couldn't handle the prolonged wet and the cold weather. So bogging and the illnesses and that come with being standing in water and mud for a long time has set in, and that's probably contributing to those losses just as much as the floodwaters is the exposure to those elements. People are out here on cattle stations because of their love of animals, and they love this industry. They love working with cattle and livestock, and people take a lot of pride in their cattle and their bloodlines and their breeding, and it can take generations to build up a herd the way you would like it, and then to see them getting washed down a river, or see them dying in along a fence line or something bogged, it's pretty heartbreaking. It's a tough thing to go through. It'll be a very tough sort of 12 months for this region rebuilding from that.
There's potentially some more rain coming from this ex-tropical cyclone. Can you and the people in your region take another downpour?
Short answer is no. No, we're very wet. The creek systems are all full. The river systems are full. This is our wet season. We like to see rain now. It's normal for us to be getting rain. But just at the moment, the ground's so wet. The rivers are so full already. And for those cattle that have been standing in water for a couple of weeks now and mud, they really need a chance to dry out. So another system coming through now. Look, it might be the last straw for a lot of cattle. It's going to be a pretty tough blow. There's been some high rainfalls recorded in the last two nights, which will bring a lot of water back down these already flooded systems. And for those guys further north who are just dealing with the peak of the water now, up through the Gulf, it's the last thing they want to see is more rain over already wet and very isolated cattle that they've got parked on high ground that they're trying to save at the moment.
Now, obviously, this has a financial impact for a lot of people, but what is the personal toll?
Yeah, it's a huge physical and mental toll on everyone at the moment. This is sort of our wet season time. There's skeleton staff up here. A lot of cattle stations got very few people on them. Yeah, it's taking a huge effort. I've just found our local community has really rallied together. A lot of businesses in town done a huge support us in the last couple of weeks. A lot of people have volunteered their time, getting flown out to stations to help people. Carting avgas and hay and things like that has been predominantly done by people that run their own businesses and that from town. People haven't stopped yet to fully comprehend what effects it's going to have, and it's going to be a long, drawn out sort of few months and year to try and recover from it.
What kind of support do you guys need at the moment?
The state and federal government have made announcements, which has been excellent. This region is predominantly cattle, grazing cattle, so what we'd like to see going forward is cattle in paddocks. So if we can restock the region, that money flows through these small towns and businesses. It gets everything up and running again. If we don't get support the region is going to really hurt for the next couple of years. Everyone will just sort of go into shutdown mode. We'll just sort of do the bare minimum to keep businesses ticking along. But if we can get some support from the government to restock cattle, some restocking grants, and with that, it's not only going to be the graziers that are going to hurt, it's going to be all those small businesses that are going to struggle over the next couple of years as we try and rebuild.
Northwest Queensland grazier Dudley Harrington speaking to Abby Holter. Now, Indonesia has made a drastic cut to the amount of boxed beef that private importers can bring into the country, permitting only 30,000 tonnes, down from 180,000 tonnes. Charles Geary spoke with Simon Quilty, who said that while this may come at the benefit of live cattle exporters, replacing that boxed beef may not be as simple as hoped for the Indonesian government.
So this is on the back of the government in Indonesia wanting to be self-sufficient, of course, and also the school lunch program that they've been aggressively putting in place over the last year, to simply replace, though, the boxed beef trade, particularly from Australia, is challenging, to say the least. In the last year, we've seen 66,000 metric tons being exported into Indonesia, and in terms of live cattle, 583,000 head. So, you know, one of the challenges there, obviously, is the capacity within Indonesia for further cattle, but also the role that boxed beef plays both in the quality end of the market, but also manufacturing, and how quickly that can be replaced. So I think it's got challenges. We welcome, you know, any additional demand for live cattle, but I don't know whether replacing boxed beef is as simple as that.
You mentioned some of the challenges with replacing boxed beef. It's something that we're already hearing some concern with within that domestic market over there in Indonesia. Are you thinking they're already recognising the challenges this decision might have for them?
I think so already, yeah. And, you know, one of the challenges here is that we could see as the year progresses that, you know, markets or suppliers such as Brazil, America, Australia will all go into rebuild. We know exports out of New Zealand will likely fall as well. So I think overall there is going to be a global tightening of protein, and therefore to simply be able to say we're going to replace one with the other, at the end of the day, it's price that matters, and the cost of cattle and of boxed beef is likely to go higher.
This must be pretty good news, though, for live exporters up here in the Territory and across Australia.
I think it is terrific news because, you know, provides yet another important outlet in the, you know, for the North and these key markets. And, you know, we've got these rains that are currently going on. Pricing this week, as I understand, has gone as high as $4.80 out of Darwin for live cattle. And this is on the basis of the tightening supply, the lack of availability of cattle due to these floods and the heavy rain. And so tightening is going on as we speak, but I think inevitably further tightening will occur as we get into the back end of this year.
Global Agri-Trends meat and livestock analyst Simon Quilty speaking to Charles Geary. Brooke Neindorf with you. Let's find out what's been happening with the weather. We're joined by Jenny Hoover at the Bureau of Meteorology. Good afternoon, Jenny.
Good afternoon, Brooke.
What's happening across the state today and looking forward?
Yeah, look, it's a relatively stable. We've still got our dominant high-pressure system to the south, maintaining that cooler south-southeasterly airstream across the state. It's been a relatively cloudy start across southern parts of the state. It's starting to break out more across our western coasts at the morning. And it's been a bit of a glum start, especially across southern coasts this morning, but not a lot in the gauge. So it's been maybe a little bit misty, some drizzle in parts, but not too much reflecting in the gauges through there. We've managed to pick up a point two of a millimetre down at Victor Harbour up until 9 a.m. and since 9 a.m. 0.6 registering in the gauge at Pandana. So even though we have seen a little bit of light shower or drizzle activity, especially around our southern coasts and ranges, we haven't really translated anything too much in the gauge through there. We've also seen a little bit of thunderstorm activity over water, especially down in the far southeast there, and maybe a little bit on those far southern coasts. Most of the activity is now moved over to Victoria, but something on the border there onto the lower southeast this afternoon, I guess, isn't out of the question through there. And it's going to be a similar pattern over the next couple of days. The high pressure centre will actually move sort of closer to Tasmania and out into the southern parts of the Tasman Sea as we head into tomorrow and the weekend, but we're still going to be under the influence of that broad high pressure ridge, maintaining that more south-southeasterly flow. So expecting, again, some cloudy starts tomorrow across southern parts, maybe a little bit of light shower activity again across our windward coasts and ranges through there. And then that thunderstorm risk lingers near the border as we head into the weekend and maybe more likely to come across on the Sunday and maybe the Monday across those southeastern districts, because we're seeing a lot of moisture coming in across the south, across the east into Victoria, but we're not quite grabbing it across. There's a little bit of uncertainty for early next week whether we can see a little bit of that moisture coming into the especially the lower southeast early next week, but we'll see how that all evolves as we get closer. But generally we are looking at those relatively stable conditions, and we are still seeing a little bit of warmth up north. So generally maximum temperatures near average in the north today, tending to below average elsewhere. And as we head into tomorrow, maybe broadly closer to average temperatures on Friday, and we'll start to see maybe some of those maximum temperatures grading to above average as we head into western parts over the weekend, and maybe a little bit more broadly above average as we head into early next week across the state. So we'll see how we go with a little bit of that warmth. So rainfall, really not expecting too much. Maybe on the Monday, if we see some of that storm activity in the southeast, we could pick up a little bit. But looking at our cumulative rainfall totals till the end of Monday across the agricultural area, generally less than a couple of millimetres cumulative. Could see some isolated totals over the next few days, getting up possibly into 2 to 10 millimetre range, especially around those southern coasts and ranges and across the southeast, and especially if we see some of that thunderstorm activity come across from Victoria there. Thanks, Brooke.
Thanks, Jenny. Have a good afternoon.
Thank you.
Jenny Horvat at the Bureau of Meteorology with all the latest from the weather there. Quick look at the western eastlands for today. For the upper western, sunny with winds south to southwesterly, 25 to 35 kilometres per hour. Overnight temperatures falling to between 19 and 24, with daytime temperatures reaching 34 to 39. For the lower western, sunny with winds southerly, 25 to 35 k's per hour. Overnight temperatures falling to between 15 and 19, with daytime temperatures reaching the low to mid 30s. Brooke Neindorf with you. It's 31 minutes past 12.
Each weekday at noon, tune into the Country Hour.
European breeds thrown in the mix, some Simmental and the odd Black Angus. It's a bit of a fruit salad.
The Country Hour.
Food of the gods.
Tune in weekdays at noon on ABC Radio and on the ABC Listen app.
This is the Country Hour on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
Thanks very much for your company on the Country Hour today. Still to come, how far do you have to travel to see a vet? Or how far does a vet have to travel to get to you? New research has found that more than 250,000 people around Australia do not have ready access to veterinary services.
The last time that I had an emergency, that was on a Saturday, and I drove to Clare. Then they did some treating there, but then they were shutting. So then I had to go from Clare to Adelaide. You know, I think living out the country, you already realise that you're going to be travelling a distance for veterinary care generally.
We'll hear more on that story very shortly, but I'd love to hear from you. What has it meant for you when you haven't had easy access to a vet? Did you have to drive longer distances in an emergency? Did a vet have to come out to you late at night? Did you have to maybe do some vet work yourself? Send me a text on 0467 922 783. We'd love to hear the issues that you face when it comes to getting vet care. But before that, let's head to the newsroom now. We're joined by Matt Coleman. Good afternoon, Matt.
Hello, Brooke. In the news this afternoon, the organisation that oversees Adelaide Writers' Week has apologised to Palestinian-Australian author Randa Abdul Fattah and says she will be invited to speak at the next event in 2027. Her invitation to this year's event was cancelled over commentary about Israel and Zionism. The Adelaide Festival Corporation says it's reversed its previous decision to exclude her. It retracts its previous statement that her appearance would have been culturally insensitive, and it apologises unreservedly for the harm it caused her. The lower River Murray will be listed as critically endangered from Friday. The federal government says its ecosystems are threatened by the over-extraction of water, feral animals, habitat loss, weeds and salinity. It will be required to assess major new developments along the lower Murray, and the state government has opened consultation for a new dog and cat breeder licensing scheme to improve animal welfare. Breeders would need to provide a detailed history and background check, while a cap of 20 fertile dogs per breeding facility would be introduced. More news at 1 o'clock.
Thanks very much, Matt. Matt Coleman in the newsroom. Let's go to Victoria again now. And Victorian winemaker and farmer Matt Fowles is still coming to terms with everything he has lost after the Longwood bushfire ripped through his property on Friday. With a huge clean-up ahead of him, he says the main priority will be finding a place for his family to live. Annie Brown reports.
Matt Fowles is a winemaker and a farmer in the Strathbogie Ranges in Victoria's northeast, and he hasn't slept properly for days.
Yeah, all my wine is in there.
Shea collection.
Yeah, last 20 years of wine collection.
He's showing me what remains of his home for the last 20 years, destroyed by bushfire, which started in the neighbouring town of Longwood last week.
I went through it just the other day, trying to figure out,
His family also lost two other houses, 1,100 head of sheep and all 120 hectares of vineyard.
If you look all around, we're both sides of the hill and you can see that it's just everything is black. Every square inch of our place was burned out, with the exception of very small areas. At just unbelievable breakneck speed, so, you know, you can see what a large area it is, and all of it was burnt out, you know, in perhaps 45 minutes. The scale and speed of it was just frightening.
I think last time we spoke to you on the Country Hour, you'd managed to save your house, but then the next day it went. What happened on Friday?
Well, yeah, Thursday we saved it once when the front came through. We saved it again later that day. There are a couple of goes at saving it on Friday, but by 10:30 on Thursday night, I'd been up since 3 a.m, and then 10:30 on Friday night, on Thursday night, the wind picked up to a level. I had my family on the phone begging me to get out. I was here on my own, and then I had great help and amazing help from the team and mates during the day, but I was actually concerned for their safety and I wanted them off the hill, and so I ended up being up there in the evening alone. And when that wind sprung up at 10:30, I was like, you know, getting the phone calls from a family and looking out at the landscape, and I just made the decision, or took the advice, which was to get out and come back when things settled down, which they obviously didn't. So I filled a car with as many photos and treasures and whatever else I could that were important to us, and then, just had to walk away.
And so what have the last few days been like for you? So it's been a couple of days now. I think it's down to a watch and act now, the fire, so things are sort of settled and sort of take stock of, everything that's been lost.
Yeah, and that's exactly what we've done. So Saturday was get all the animals off the place. And I've got to say, just acknowledge it, our team, a lot of them hadn't fought fires before, and they've stuck around, they've come back as soon as it was safe to do so, and they've been working day and night to get stuff done. So we unfortunately we lost about 1,100 sheep, and that, you can imagine what a horrible job that is. So they're all buried now, and so it was literally taking stock of livestock, and we got, you know, a couple of horses made it. I mean, the kids were delighted that the chickens at home made it. I don't even know how. I just don't get it, how random fire is. I've got my wife and kids returning today and tomorrow. So my priority is them. I've got to find beds for my babies. I've had I've been overwhelmed with kindness and offers. You know, we might have had 15 different houses offered to us now. So we've just got to find the one, the situation that best suits our family for the next couple of years while we think about rebuilding. But in terms of next steps, I just, you know, I've got to look after my girls, and that's number one. And then I really haven't thrown my head too far past that. So I've just got to, where, you know, the team's cleaning up. You can probably hear them in the background. And they're pushing really hard so that, you know, we'll get that initial work done. And then at some point we're going to take a breath and get some good heads in the room and figure out what we need to do.
You mentioned to me earlier about that support and offer of help that you've had and received over the last few days. It sounds like it's come from all over the country. It's kind of amazing, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a really beautiful part of this awful event. My friendship network has been overwhelmingly kind. The community here and further abroad, and then also the wine industry, you know, because in a circumstance like this where your life is essentially ripped away from you, you're presented with a blank canvas, and the easiest thing to do would be to walk away. And over the last few days, the wine industry has rallied. I've had offers of fruit for vintage from perhaps a dozen different wineries now. I've had someone in Western Australia offering to tanker us wine, bulk wine, and it's just overwhelmingly beautiful messages and offers of support. And it, you know, at a time like this where your life is thrown up in your face and you've got to make decisions about where to next, which I really haven't got onto yet, but with that kindness and that feeling of community in the wine industry, it makes me realise how special it is. And it makes me think, God, I just want to be a part of it ongoing. So if I was a betting man, at some point not too far from now, I'll find the reserves to muscle up and get back into it. The only thing, other thing I'd say is, you know, people tend to stay away when there's bushfires, and rightly so. But now it is safe and the roads are open, and this community is going to need a boatload of help and support and kindness, which is we're seeing a lot of, but it's going to need to be ongoing as well. So, you know, our restaurant is open, but it's not busy because people have stayed away. So as soon as people feel comfortable, come back to the region, not just to our place, but to everyone, and get around them. And, you know, the people have asked, how can I help? Well, the simplest way is to get online and buy wine, or our neighbour's wine, or our businesses down the road. Just get around them, because we're going to need it, frankly.
Matt Fowles, winemaker and farmer from the Strathbogie Ranges, speaking to Annie Brown from his farm there. And you can read more and see more photos from Matt's property. Just head to abc.net.au/rural. And over the you know, the next few days and weeks coming, we'll hope to bring to you how South Australians can support those Victorians going through that, and also those in Queensland as well suffering from those floods too. So make sure you stay tuned there, and we'll try and bring you as much information as possible when it comes to maybe donating hay or adjusting livestock and where you can visit and things like that as well. Rook Neindorf with you. It is coming up to 18 minutes to 1.
On the ABC Listen app, stream a wide range of free audiobooks from the likes of Kate Morton, James Patterson, Candace Fox and William McInnes.
A man's gotta have a hobby.
No catch, no cost. Find free audiobooks on the ABC Listen app.
You're listening to The Country Hour on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
Juicy, crunchy, sweet table grapes. At Talia Farms at Lirrup in the Riverland, the harvest has begun, which is the earliest start ever for the team. Farms manager Bill Avery told Eliza Burlarge that the change is due to a new variety.
Actually, next week's our normal starting time, the 19th, and it looks like we're going to be a couple of days early that we'll probably start harvesting that main variety on the 17th, so just after the Ruby Rush. So at this stage, everything's on time, on schedule.
Yes, all stations go, and we're hearing so much about some of these new varieties. Yeah, have you had to change, as you said, it's an earlier start date, but have you had to change much else in your operations and management for this newer variety?
No, we're pretty much set up for any variety. The only thing is harvest labour high, so we've had to secure our harvest labour force earlier, make sure they're accommodated in the region and have been trained and all that sort of stuff before we start. So that's probably 2 weeks earlier than we have previously. And it sort of works very well locally because it dovetails into the end of the blueberry harvest season. So there's a lot of accommodation comes available after that. And it works out very well.
And Ruby Rush, just for people that might not have heard of this variety, what's that one like?
Yeah, so if they're familiar or if people are familiar with the Crimson Seedless, it's very similar in look to a Crimson Seedless, the only variation being that it's a good month earlier. So it's one of the first red varieties into the market around the same time as what we call Flame Seedless, which is a public variety.
And you guys have, how many varieties do you have?
We have 11 different varieties, a mixture of green grapes, red grapes and black grapes, so that we can fill the market window from January through till the end of March.
How has all the fruit been looking so far?
Yeah, so it's been a great year for growing fruit in the cool spring that we've had. We've only had a couple of severe heat events, and probably the worst one was last week, which could have had some detrimental effect to the fruit. But as we have cooling sprinkler systems within the patches, we managed to keep the temperature inside the canopy at under 35 degrees, so that was all fine.
Oh, what a relief, because I imagine that there's going to be a lot of demand for your grapes. What's that looking like?
Yeah, so demand this year has kicked off better than last year. Last year was not such a good year. It was super hot in spring and did cause a lot of damage to fruit quality early on. But this year, we've had that really mild spring and only a couple of heat events over that crucial spring period. And the fruit's looking very, very good and clean. Obviously, there's the fruit fly issue within the region and also across Australia, which we've started all the programs for that 6 to 8 weeks ago, bait spraying and all the government regulatory stuff so that we can export our fruit or send our fruit out of the region.
And where do some of your grapes end up?
All corners of the globe, anywhere from the UAE, Middle East, Southeast Asia, New Zealand, and even occasionally we send gear up to Canada.
That's incredible. And I've heard... you guys have quite a sophisticated operation to be able to pick them really quick and get them off fresh to all of those different countries.
That's right, yeah. So we're back to the future farming, so we've gone back to packing the grapes actually in a pack shed. And the only variation on that is, which is the 1980s style of fruit packing before the labour costs become too high. So what we've done now, we pick at night with the headlamps on and we pack during the day. So we start at 3 o'clock in the morning, 2:30, depending on the dew point, and then we'll start picking. And by 9 o'clock in the morning, the pickers are finished and the pack shed's full, ready to pack by 7 a.m. So there's no stopping the process, and we go right through till 6 p.m. And our fruit is then stored, ready for dispatch that night. So we're the only pack shed in Australia that can pick, pack and palletise and ready for dispatch in 24 hours. So.
Wow, that's an incredibly quick turnaround, and obviously you need lots of staff for that.
Yeah, and it certainly helps longevity or shelf life by picking at night. We're getting an extra 3 to 4 days shelf life on the fruit because it's being picked when it's cool as opposed to being picked when it's hot. So, yeah, it's pretty good.
And do most of your grapes, do they end up overseas or is there some on the domestic market?
Predominantly overseas due to the small volume of Australian domestic product. There is very limited what you call supply numbers to the chain stores, so it's controlled by 3 to 5 major suppliers to the chain stores. So unless you're in with those groups, it's very hard to break into the supermarket chains because they won't entertain an individual grower base. So hence why we've focused predominantly 80% to 90% export, 10% domestic.
Yeah, amazing. And how much are you seeing volumes and demand for that change in your time in the industry, that in the exports? You know, how much is that growing?
Yeah, so it's really an amazing growth pattern for the export. When I first started in the late 80s, we're still sending fruit to the EU, which wasn't the EU then. We used to send directly to England. Then the EU came in, which virtually was a trade block for Australian produce. So we had to find alternate markets, which ended up being Hong Kong primarily. And then as from then on, it sort of grew out to the other Asian countries and China as well. And so it's been a very quick rise. We're almost approaching $700 million worth of exports in this small sector. So we're getting approaching the $1 billion mark. We went from 600 pre-COVID to about 700 now. So obviously the COVID had a pretty big effect on volumes going overseas with all the restrictions and so forth, but it's just starting to ramp back up again now. There's plenty of growth in the export market. The only difference really has been the different colours of grapes. So red grapes were very popular in Asia, and then black grapes started to creep up, and then the white grapes dropped away. But now they're going back to, and I should clarify that, white grapes are green grapes. Mm-hmm. So the market's now swinging back to green grapes would be 60% of the market, 25 to 30% red, and the blacks are the remaining 15%. So, yeah, that's the biggest thing, is really the change of varieties and change of colours.
And what sort of prices are you guys getting for your grapes? Has it been looking like it's going to be good for you guys for returns from overseas?
Yeah, that's a million-dollar question for fresh produce. So you really don't know really from week to week what you're going to get. You can have a range, like you might have a range of, say, $4.50 to $8.50 a kilo, depending on quality, premiums and colours. But that can fluctuate within a week. So you've got to have a pretty strong heart when you're in this game. So
absolutely. And you've been in it for a while. Yeah, just quickly, I just wanted to circle back. Yeah, what's the turnaround between, you know, off the farm to someone else's plate overseas? I guess
it depends on what country. Like the earlier stuff, because everything revolves around Chinese New Year for us, so it's a later Chinese New Year this year. So there's a premium paid for pre-Chinese New Year fruit. So that allows us then to air freight. So we're looking at 48 hours from dispatch to on when in a fruit shop in, say, Southeast Asia. If we send by sea, it's 21 days. So 21 to 22 days, depending on which ports we're going into. So you're looking at 3 weeks from dispatch, it would be inside a fruit store somewhere overseas.
Pretty cool turnaround. That was Talia Farms Manager Bill Avery speaking with Eliza Burlage about that test, the table grapes and the harvest that has started. Now, how close is your nearest vet and how hard is it to get there? I'd love to hear from you. You can send me a text on 0467 922 783. Now, some new research has found that more than 250,000 people around Australia do not have ready access to veterinary services. Though a workforce shortage has been blamed for access issues previously, Dr. Bronwyn Orr, veterinarian and former president of the Australian Veterinary Association, says there is more at play.
More than 250,000 Australians do not have access to a veterinarian. And we define that as within 60-minute drive. Unfortunately, the vast majority of those people live in rural and regional locations. What it really boils down to is that veterinary care in Australia is completely subject to the free market. What that means is there's no subsidies, there's no government intervention. There's got to be enough people in that region to sustain a veterinarian being there so that they can pay their bills and pay their mortgage and live. It really is a failure of the free market and really strongly indicates that without government intervention, that this is something that is going to get worse and we are going to see some unfortunate side effects such as poor animal welfare and probably scariest of all, biosecurity breaches, because we don't have people like veterinarians on the ground in the local communities and keeping an eye and ear out for things. Because for diseases like foot and mouth disease, every single day that you delay detection costs hundreds of millions, sometimes billions of dollars if we're talking a couple of week delay. This is going to get worse. And I do believe that eventually we'll get an incursion of a much more serious disease and it will be picked up too late. So it will result in significant impacts on the livestock producers and the local communities. If I can be blunt, veterinary services are use it or lose it. So if you don't use your local veterinarian, if you're not going to them for these regular routine things, they're not going to be there in an emergency. They just can't support themselves. There's no financial support for them. So we're kind of facing this situation now where either government steps in to help subsidize veterinary practices in rural areas, like we see in Canada and the US and even the UK, or we accept that rural communities will start losing access to veterinary services on a more permanent basis, and that will just be the way it is. You just won't be able to get veterinary care for your pets, for your livestock in a lot of parts of Australia.
Dr. Bronwyn Orr speaking about her research. The government spokesperson says the South Australian government is aware of these proposals and acknowledges they are being discussed both nationally and within South Australia. They said matters such as incentives for veterinarians working in regional and rural areas, workforce attraction, retention and mental health initiatives are being examined by a joint parliamentary committee established by the South Australian Parliament. Veterinarian and Director of Clare Valley Veterinary Services, Dr. Sophie Brown, says she regularly sees clients who have travelled far.
We would probably see 6 to 8 clients a day who have travelled anywhere from half an hour to an hour and a half to come to us.
How much do you do in terms of farm and livestock work?
Like livestock and horses probably take up 25 to 30% of our business. So we do a lot of on-property visits for herd health. We work very closely with our local PRSA vets and animal health officers, but we can't be everywhere at once.
In terms of that 1 hour distance, mm-hmm. if a dog has been bitten by a snake or there's been some kind of health emergency, mm-hmm. how important is the hour that it takes to get care?
Yeah, it's fundamental in cases. So snake bite, definitely. We've had people, you know, call from Peterborough or Uru with a snake bite dog, and they get very, very close to us and have to turn around and go back because the dog has died in the car, or, you know, they get here and there's nothing we can do. There's a lot of other emergencies that we see that, you know, we should see them sooner than we can, but it's a time thing. It's when we can leave the building to get to them or when they can get down to us.
One of the regions Dr. Brown services is Yunta, nearly 200 kilometres away. Just outside Yunta on Panoramity Station, Lisa Crawford organises semi-regular visits from the vet.
The travel costs are very prohibitive, and not everyone can manage. We're talking hundreds and hundreds of dollars each visit. So if you're just getting your dog vaccinated, for example, it's quite hard for people to afford. I guess if you work like me full time, not only do you have to take a day off to get your animals down to a vet, so then you've lost your income for that day, you got the practicality. So for me, I've got a horse, so to travel a horse somewhere for shots or something small, it's not practical. So they do come regularly enough, which is good. So that helps you when you've got scheduled care needs. There is no emergency vet anywhere near us, and if you're out of hours. Now Adelaide is the closest vet, which is 3.5 to 4 hours away, depending on where you live. The last time that I had an emergency, that was on a Saturday, and I drove to Clare. You know, they did some treating there, but then they were shutting. So then I had to go from Clare to Adelaide. When you're on your own, you're already in a flustered state, and then you're dealing with trying to keep the pet calm, get yourself there. You know, I think living out in the country, you already realise that you're going to be travelling a distance for veterinary care generally. That is what it is. But the lack of emergency services is a real issue. In a lot of these scenarios, it's not going to be a good outcome. I do think that as much as funding's always the solution to every problem, it really is regional, I guess, areas need that extra funding. You've got these communities that need the support that the cities get. So we should be being able to still get the same services that you would get in the city, albeit they may be more expensive or they may be more difficult to source, but you should still be able to get them. I don't know that any other solution other than funding is going to achieve that.
Lisa Crawford from Panoramity Station, ending that report from Isabella Kelly. And you can read more of that story online at abc.net.au/rural. We've had a text come through. I was asking how far you have to travel for vet services. Driving from Streaky Bay to Port Lincoln, which is 300 kilometres for this person's dog, and then 300 kilometres home. So thank you for texting that in. I know a lot of people do travel and have to come down to Port Lincoln here on the Eyre Peninsula. And many more Ks as well. So a 600K round trip for an appointment. Brooke Neindorf with you. It's 1:04.
On the ABC Listen app, stream a wide range of free audiobooks from the likes of Kate Morton, James Patterson, Candace Fox and William McInnes.
A man's got to have a hobby.
No catch, no cost. Find free audiobooks on the ABC Listen app.
This is ABC Radio Adelaide, South Australia and Broken Hill.
Finally today, let's go to the Mount Compass Markets, and Elsie Adamo has the numbers. Hi, Elsie.
Good afternoon, Brooke. Numbers increased this week as agents offered 850 live weight and open auction cattle, 350 more than last week. Quality was again extremely mixed, with smaller lot sizes across the offering. The usual trade and processor buyers were in attendance, along with feeders and restockers, providing steady competition. Veeler steers sold mostly firm, ranging from 380 to 387 cents, with heifers also firm, selling from 385 to 433 cents per kilogram. Yearling steers and heifers eased 10 to 15 cents per kilogram, as steers range from 380 to 463 cents, with heifers fetching 335 to 440 cents per kilogram. Manufacturing steers sold from 435 to 467 cents, Grain steers eased 10 to 15 cents per kilogram, selling from 350 to 467 cents, with heifers mostly firm and returning 360 to 457 cents per kilogram. Medium beef cows gained 5 cents per kilogram, selling from 319 to 395 cents. Heavy cows eased 10 cents per kilogram, returning 337 to 429 cents, with dairy breeds fetching 310 to 406 cents per kilogram. Bulls sold from 375 to 430 cents per kilogram. This has been Elsie Adamo reading a report prepared by John Traeger for the MLA's National Livestock Reporting Service.
Thanks very much, Elsie. That's all we've got time for on the Country Hour today. Before we go, I had another text come through. We're talking about vet distances and how far you have to travel. Someone else has texted in to say they've had to go from Cooper Pedy to Port Augusta, and they do have a vet that visits once a month, sort of roughly, but if your pet gets sick or you can't wait, there is no other option. So, yeah, plenty of Ks there done to get access to vet services for your animals. And you can read more about that story online and some new research looking at those distances having to travel for vet access online at abc.net.au/rural. I'll be back with you at the same time tomorrow morning. Have a good Thursday afternoon, whatever you're up to. It's coming up to news time. It's 1 o'clock.
The ABC Listen app lets you take ABC Radio with you wherever you go. At home, in the gym, up a ladder, on the road,
interstate,
outer space. Download the ABC Listen app today.
Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.